Part 4. Hélène. It is one thing to study war, and another to live the warrior's life. Telamon of Arcadia, mercenary of the 5th century BC. Madame André. Friedfond, Cantal, France, June 1944.
Where in the name of Winston Churchill are we going to find a radio and transmitter? I demand.
It is now sunset, and while my mood has not improved, my clarity of thought has, thanks to a long nap. Dennis scratches the stubble on his chin.
I think I might know. Do tell, because I'm out of ideas.
15 different emotions chase one another across his face, and I cannot name a single one of them. Finally, after some intense, silent deliberation, he says,
There is an SOE radio operator in Châteauroux. His name is Alex. He will help you if you tell him that I have sent you.
Oh, his lover. Does this Alex have a last name? He clears his throat.
I never asked. That was our arrangement. First names only, you know. In case, I know.
In case they get captured, interrogated. We've all made these little arrangements with those we care about, ways of keeping each other safe.
How will I convince him that I'm not some German spy? I ask. His group uses a bit of nursery rhyme as their password.
Dennis tells it to me, and I commit it to memory.
Hubert consults the Michelin map that he keeps folded and tucked inside his boot.
Dennis and I both watch as he finds our current location with one finger. He taps that spot, then searches the map for Châteauroux. I see the fingers of his left hand pop up one by one as he does the arithmetic. After a few seconds, he looks at us, stricken.
That is 250 kilometers away.
As we have been pondering our predicament, we are joined by Anselm, Jacques, then Gaspard, and finally Fournier, who sweeps me into a giant hug.
What is 250 kilometers away? He asks.
The closest radio and transmitter, Hubert answers, since ours was disposed of at Friedfond.
Dennis, tired of defending himself, shouts,
Protocol!
Then there's only one thing to be done, I say.
And what is that? Hubert asks.
I will go to Châteauroux and speak with this radio operator. I will ask him to message London on our behalf and request new equipment.
And how are you going to get there?
I point at Fournier.
I will take his Renault. I can be back before lunch tomorrow.
Fournier was one of 24 group leaders who drove, first from the Chaudaigu Plateau to Friedfond, and then to Saint-Saintin. Fournier shakes his head.
No, you cannot drive. It is too dangerous. The Germans have installed roadblocks across the entire region. You will never make it through.
You made it here safely enough.
I was driving on dirt tracks in a heavily wooded area beneath a canopy. There is little but national highway between here and Châteauroux. It is entirely different.
Besides, he looks right at me.
Where was your identity card issued?
The Cantal.
Then it is useless. All cards issued in the Cantal have been invalidated. The Germans have ordered them all to be exchanged at local police stations under supervision of the Gestapo. You cannot show your face in a police station, and you cannot make the drive without papers. Anyone caught without proper identification is sent to the Nazi garrison in Montluçon for interrogation.
Be that as it may, without a radio we cannot stop the Germans from advancing north. All our work will have been for nothing.
I shake my head, unwilling to accept defeat. I am going to Châteauroux one way or another.
Fournier snorts.
Do you intend to walk? It would take you a week just to get there.
He's right. It's been 5 days since we were last in communication with London. We don't have another 5 to spare. I cannot walk,
I cannot drive. But there is one other option. I will bicycle. This brings a rousing chorus of laughter from my companions. I suppose one of you has a better idea? That shuts them up. None of you can go, I say. You're so bloody male, so bloody obvious. One look at you and the Boche would know your resistance. I can get through without much attention. No one in this country ever seems to notice a woman on a bicycle. I could ride across your upper lip and you'd never look twice. Your bicycle was left on the plateau, Hubert reminds me. Then I'll have to buy another one in Saint-Saintin. Gaspard nods his great shaggy head beside me.
It's a good plan, if not for one small flaw.
Which is?
You look like shit. You're dressed in filthy trousers and British army boots. No German patrol would mistake you for an innocent French housewife.
He's right. Over the last 6 days, I have been through a battle, shot at by an aeroplane, watched my truck get blown to bits, crossed a river, and have slept in the woods 5 nights straight. It pains me to admit that Gaspard has a point. Then what do you propose?
If you are going to do this, you'll need new clothes.
He sniffs.
A bath and a bicycle. Who is going to acquire all of that for you?
Jacques steps forward, shoulders back, and says, I will.
Saint-Saintin. Is there no way I can talk you out of this?
Fournier asks the next morning as we sit beside a small campfire.
None whatsoever.
Then how can I help?
I am ready for my trip, thanks to Jacques, who purchased my bicycle, clothing, and a small amount of food in Saint-Saintin last night. What I do not have is any idea what I've gotten myself into. I need a route, I tell him, along with a sense of where the German troop movements will be. There's no point going to all this trouble if I'm just going to end up arrested and shot.
Fournier nods. I will send a few men ahead of you into the Cantal and the Puy de Dôme to tell the villagers to look out for you and warn you of any trouble. But you'll be on your own in the Allier. You'll have to trust luck.
All that's left for me to do is bathe. I'd like a tub and a hot water spout, but that is out of the question, even if I thought it was safe to waltz into town on my own. The fact is that we've run out of time. I have to find that radio sooner rather than later. We are massed in Saint-Saintin, and it's only a matter of time before the Germans realize it. Only this time, we won't be able to defend ourselves because we have only small weapons and limited ammunition. If they discover us, we will be slaughtered. So it's a cold dunk in the stream for me.
Dennis, I say, come with me.
Why?
I need you to stand guard.
He may have lost his radio, but he's still in possession of his service revolver. And given the fact that he abhors using the thing, I know he hasn't fired a shot. Dennis has all his bullets.
Over what?
Me.
Have to piss again, do you, ducky?
No, I need a bath.
Well, why the blooming hell do you want me to come along?
Because I don't have to worry that you're going to peek. As I suspected, Dennis Rake stands still as a stump, back turned to me, as I strip naked and wade into a shallow pool in the closest stream. I gasp the second my toe hits the water. He laughs.
Shut up, I tell him. For as little as I care to see you naked, ducky, I would love to catch a glimpse of the expression on your face right now. Turn around and it will be the last thing you see.
Dennis Rake never turns, but he does chuckle the entire time I bathe. Every gasp, gurgle, curse, and mutter brings another round of cackling.
You're enjoying this a bit too much, I tell him, teeth chattering.
Serves you right.
What's that supposed to mean?
Payback is a bitch, he says. I scoop up a handful of frigid water and toss it at the back of his head. He gasps and swats at his hair, but never turns around.
How was I supposed to know you sleep naked? I ask.
You weren't, that's the point, he says. then adds, "How's that water feel, ducky? Cold enough for you? Ha ha, feeling avenged, are you? Indeed, I do believe there is a God in heaven after all."
I've got a bar of soap in my pack, and I put it to good use, scrubbing every inch of my skin, hair, and fingernails. I watch brown suds slip away in the gentle current, revealing pink, raw skin underneath. A few more full-body dunks, and I'm done. It is June, and the sun is shining. The air is warm. And since I don't have anything close to a towel, I sit on a rock beside the stream, chin tilted, hair dripping down my back, until I'm somewhat dry. I grab my pack from beside the stream, comb my hair, pull on new underclothes, I forego the stockings, then get dressed in the skirt, blouse, and walking shoes that have been purchased for me. Not what I would have gotten for myself, but they're clean and they fit well enough. It's been so long since I've worn anything other than boots and trousers that I feel strangely vulnerable. I feel more like a woman and less like a warrior. But perhaps that is a good thing, given the task ahead of me. Route Nationale. I am very careful about what I place in my string bag. Money, my toiletries, the last bottle of brandy that Buckmaster sent me, a small loaf of bread and a little wheel of brie that Jacques purchased for me in Saint-Saintin. That's it. I can't pack for a long journey. I am simply a French housewife out for the day. So I fold my Michelin map, tuck it inside the waistband of my skirt, and push off toward the Route Nationale. The nearest stretch of road is also the most trafficked, but there is no way to get from Saint-Saintin to Châteauroux without first taking the two-lane highway that runs north. I walk my bike the first 10 kilometers instead of riding, in case I am approached by any German patrols. It will be easier to ditch the bike, dive into a ditch, and wait until they pass if I have that extra few seconds' warning. At Saint-Girons, I consult my map, then switch to a smaller country road and begin cycling. The first 5 hours aren't all that bad. I'm rested, I'm fed, and the sun is warm. Once I've gotten up to speed, it's easy to maintain. I conserve my energy for the hills and coast down the other side, stopping to drink from streams when I'm thirsty. I nibble on cheese and bread before starting again to keep my growling stomach at bay. I ride all morning and into the early afternoon, determined to get as many kilometers behind me as possible. 20, 50, 75. By the time the sun has passed its zenith, my legs are growing tired. I am sweating. My hair is damp along the nape of my neck. My tailbone throbs, and I can feel the dull ache of chafing along my inner thighs. And not for the first time, I am cursing whatever sadistic man designed the bicycle seat. By 4 o'clock, I am exhausted. There is not a cloud in the sky. I can feel the hot breath of the sun blaze a path through the part in my hair. My scalp is hot. I stop for a drink, but the idea of eating anything makes me nauseated. I allow myself 5 minutes to rest and stretch my legs. Then I plunge my hands into the stream, leaving them there until my fingers are so cold they tingle. I lift my skirt and set my palms against the irritated patches on my thighs. I dare not look to see how badly they are blistered. Buckmaster! I spit his name as though it's a curse word. Bury the radio my ass. I'll tell you what I think of your stupid protocols the next time we meet. I shift routes again in the early evening to bypass Montluçon and its Nazi garrison. Roger Le Neveu was stationed there. I have not forgotten him or what he did to Patrick O'Leary. And I suspect that, given its proximity to Tam, Obersturmführer Wolf might be stationed there now. I do not want to come across him or his infamous whip without my service revolver. Hubert and I deliberated long and hard about whether I should bring it with me. If captured, I could not explain my way out of having a British-issued military piece. And yet, I will likely need it. Round and round the mulberry bush we went. The simple fact, however, is that French housewives don't carry them. And if I am to succeed in this mission,
I must be convincing. So I left it in Hubert's care, along with my pack. And now I am defenseless. By sunset, I can no longer sit on my bicycle seat. I stand up to ride and my energy fades with the light. Each push of the pedal grows harder than the last. The soreness radiates from the front of my legs to the back. The muscles in my arse begin to burn and spasm. "Let someone else volunteer next time," I mutter to myself. "Keep your damn mouth shut, Nancy." I make a deal with myself that I will continue riding until the light is gone. It keeps me going another 30 minutes. And then I come to a long, sloping hill. My lungs ache at the sight of it. I get off and push my bike to the top. My legs do not consider this a break, however. They tremble and quake with every step. I've been gripping the handlebars for so long, there are blisters bubbling up on my palms, and my knuckles ache from the pressure. My hands are swollen, my feet are swollen. I am at the top of the hill. Below me stretches a broad valley, and at the far side, the lights of Saint-Armand. I have biked over 200 kilometers in one day. My knees buckle with relief, but I remind myself that the most dangerous part of my journey is ahead. The valley is littered with little farms, and I search for a barn that is not close to any house. There is only one, and it appears to store seed, not animals. I stash my bicycle between a roll of hay and the barn and go inspect the interior. It is so dark inside that I can barely see. A mound of old hay is piled into one corner, but I glare at it. "Not this time," I say. "I will not suffer scabies along with blisters, bruises, and total body failure." Once more, I demand an excruciating feat from my body. I climb a rickety ladder into the loft. I would be delighted to find bare floorboards, but what greets me is even better. The loft is filled with sacks of alfalfa seed. It smells sweet and musty. I kick off my shoes, unbutton my blouse, push my skirt off my hips. I stand there, wearing nothing but my underclothes, letting the cool night air dry the sweat along my skin. Then I hang my clothes over the rail to dry. I crawl onto the sacks, wedging them around my body to support thighs, back, and neck. I do not think, I do not worry, I do not pray. I simply disappear into that great void of consciousness known as sleep. I am woken by air raid sirens. Thin silver light drifts through the rafters, so I know the sun hasn't risen yet. Every muscle in my body throbs, but I have to get up. It takes one mighty push, and I time my scream to coincide with the siren. Just one, that is all I allow myself. And then I am shoving myself onto all fours. Sit, stand, slowly, very slowly twist and turn my body. Lift my knees, crane my neck. Get the blood flowing again so I don't pass out and tumble over the railing. I take stock of my physical situation. There are blisters on my feet, thighs, and palms. My tailbone is bruised. The skin on my thighs is raw, chafed, and angry. My scalp is sunburned. My lips are cracked. And there is no actual word in the English language to explain the state of my muscles. I am surprised by how difficult it is to get my clothing on, how hard it is to zip my skirt and button my blouse, to pull on my walking shoes. The bread and cheese is all I have for breakfast, so I nibble it, standing in the hayloft as I listen for the whine of falling bombs. Nothing. After 5 minutes, the sirens die down. I listen for the distant drone of aeroplanes, but the skies are silent. A false alarm. I know that the brandy won't do anything to numb the pain in my body, but I decide it will help me feel better about the situation. I allow myself a single long swallow, then stretch again before climbing down from the loft. I retrieve my bicycle, brush my hair, gather my string bag, and hang it over the handlebars. Now, I look like any other woman headed into market early on a Saturday morning. By the time I hit the outskirts of Saint-Armand, I am hidden in a crowd of 20 different women cycling into town. I look for a good place to gather information about what's ahead of me. I choose a cafe populated by old men and park my bicycle beside a table on the patio. I offer my best smile to a group playing cards at a nearby table. Bonjour. They tip their hats, offer toothless grins, mutter quietly among themselves. I hear one of them say he wishes he was 50 years younger, and this pleases me, not because I want the attention, but because the ruse is working. I don't sit gracefully, it is more of an exhausted plop, but at least I don't burst into tears, and that is the main goal. When the waiter comes, I order coffee and am delighted to discover that they have it, so I request 2 cups. They have no cream or sugar, but I'm happy to drink it black. After my first sip, I ask the old men what news there is today.
Bourges was raided yesterday, one of them tells me.
I think he must be the leader of the group, because he possesses the greatest number of teeth.
The Germans took 5 men from a bistro and beat them in the street. Then they shot the hostages when they had nothing useful to tell.
It is not hard to appear shocked. I will never not be shocked by this kind of brutality. Are the Germans still in Bourges?
I do not think so. They rumbled through town on their way back to Montluçon, cracking their whips in the air.
I have to clear my throat before I ask. Whips?
Just the one, another old man says. Only one of them had a whip. The garrison commander, ugly fils de pute.
None of them argue this fact. Do you know his name? I ask. The garrison commander? While the designation of a whip isn't all that common in Hitler's military, there are many Obersturmführers, and I need to be sure.
No,
the man says, and several others shake their heads. Then the group leader picks a bit of coffee ground from between his 2 front teeth with the end of his tongue and says,
My son lives near the garrison in Montluçon and has told me about this man. He is cruel and evil. His name is Wolf.
I finish my coffee before it turns cold, then wish the men good day. When I cycle through Bourges an hour later, the town is silent. Businesses are closed. Shades are drawn. Mourning hangs thick in the air. I do not know which street the men were killed on, so I keep my eyes off the ground and get through town as fast as I can. I have seen enough bloody cobblestones to last a lifetime. I make Issoudun by lunchtime, and I am badly in need of another break. So I make my way into the town square and walk my bicycle through the local market, hoping no one notices how I must lean on it for balance or how I wince with each step. I move slowly, perusing the stalls, buying as much produce as I can fit in the basket at the front of my bicycle. Squash, zucchini, peaches, a loaf of bread, another small wheel of cheese. I arrange them carefully and hope that I pass for a housewife doing her weekend shopping. There is a German checkpoint at the far end of Issoudun, so I duck into an alley between 2 houses and run the brush through my hair. I coat my lips in victory red. I set my jaw and square my shoulders, then press on, determined not to look as though I am avoiding the checkpoint. When I draw close, I can feel the Germans staring at me. I climb off the bike and join the queue. I force myself not to limp. When my turn comes to pass between the gates, I look at the guard in charge.
Halt!
He shouts. My heart stutters. I think about the price on my head. The description of me that has been passed from one Gestapo headquarters to another. My nickname, the White Mouse. He motions me forward, then yanks my string bag out of the basket. I watch him as he rifles through my belongings.
What is this?
He demands, waving the brandy bottle in my face.
Lunch.
This gets a laugh from his colleagues, and the tip of the guard's nose turns pink.
"For me," he says,
then waves me on without replacing the bottle. The road to Chateau Roux curves to the south and is littered with German vehicles, so I cycle west to Briand, then southwest to Villedieu-sur-Indre, and enter Chateau Roux at its northern end. I was lucky that the guard did not ask for my papers, but I might not be so lucky again. I cross the main bridge into town, cycle through the roundabout, and take the second exit onto the main street. The house at the edge of town looks exactly as Denden described it, but I am far less graceful with my approach down the paved walkway than I would like. I drop my bike at the gate and limp, bow-legged, toward the door so my thighs won't rub together. It swings open before I can knock.
"Who are you?"
a middle-aged gentleman with muddy eyes and a widow's peak asks. His French is terrible. "A friend," I say in English, then give the bit of nursery rhyme Dennis instructed me to use. "Silver bells and cockle shells." He opens the door wider and I step in. The little house is almost bare of furniture but for a kitchen table, two chairs and one long bench where a couch ought to be. I assume there are beds in the bedrooms, but the doors are closed and I cannot see. I have so many questions and no time to ask them.
"How can I help you?"
the man asks. "I am André," I tell him, "and I have a message for Alex."
"I'm Bernard,"
he extends his hand,
"and I'm afraid that's not possible."
"Why not?" he winces.
"Alex is not here."
"When will he be back?"
"Never."
Unease settles heavily onto my shoulders.
"What has happened?" "He was shot by the Germans yesterday, in Bourges."
My unease turns to despair.
"Why was he in Bourges?"
Bernard shrugs.
"He goes the first Saturday of every month. I do not know why."
I drop into one of the kitchen chairs, then drop my forehead to the rough wood and begin to cry. I cannot help myself.
"You mean to tell me that you have no radio operator?"
I have failed. My chest heaves with sobs. The man is speaking to me, but I cannot hear him over the sound of my own self-pity. Finally, he shakes me by the shoulder.
"Madam, did you hear me?"
he asks.
"No. I said I can work the radio, but it won't do you any good."
"Why not?"
"Because I can't code the messages."
My tears stop as quickly as they came.
"I can."
The message is short. "Hélène to London. Position abandoned. Protocol enacted. Request new radio and transmitter. Send to 44.6489 degrees north, 2.2182 degrees east. Urgent." I double-check the coordinates for the small clearing outside Saint-Saintin three times before handing Bernard the message. He is not quite so efficient in typing it out as Denden, but it gets through nonetheless. 10 minutes later, his machine begins to chirp.
"London confirmed your message," he says. "They will deliver your radio at 1 o'clock in the morning tomorrow."
"Thank you," I tell him. "You just saved 7,000 lives." And then I shuffle toward the doorway.
"Where are you going?"
he asks.
"Back to my camp."
"Right now? It's after midnight."
"Yes. And about this time tomorrow I have to be in Saint-Saintin to collect an airdrop from London because my friends don't know it's coming."
I do not have scabies. I feared that my night spent in the barn would have infected me even though I didn't sleep in the hay. This is the only thing I can find to be grateful for when I climb back onto my bicycle. Otherwise, I might just lie down in a ditch and die. Because whatever pain I felt yesterday is nothing compared to what descends upon me during the night as I pedal south.
I could not handle this agony and the crawling, oozing, unrelenting itch of scabies as well. I do not care about Germans or checkpoints or danger. I must get back to Saint-Saintin. My only goal is to find the quickest route home, and I stop only to consult the map, peering at it in the moonlight. Every kilometer is pure agony. By 3 o'clock in the morning, I am certain that if I get off this bicycle, I will never get on again. I no longer stop or look at the map. I rely on memory and instinct and the base desire to no longer be in pain. I have rubbed all the skin from my inner thighs. Blood oozes down my legs, soaking into the hem of my skirt. I can no longer sit on the seat. I can no longer stand on the pedals. I have to do these things anyway. I sit until my thighs are screaming. I stand until my hamstrings are screaming. Then I do it again, alternating back and forth between the two. My breath is fire. My blood is lava. My jaw is clenched. My throat is parched. The kilometers fall away as I press forward in a trance. By the time I push my bicycle into the French resistance camp at Saint-Saintin, I have pedaled 500 kilometers round trip. My friends stare at me, speechless, as I take the last excruciating steps toward the campfire. The edges of my vision grow dark, shrinking like a pair of binoculars facing the wrong direction. I see nothing but tunnels with pricks of light at the end. I let my bicycle fall to the ground beside me as I teeter on my feet, unable to maintain my balance. "London is sending a new radio and transmitter at 1 o'clock in the morning," I say. All goes black, and I can feel myself falling through the air, but I have no idea whether anyone moves to catch me. Lucienne Callier. Marseille, March 1st, 1943. I don't let myself cry until I am across the street, around the corner, and one block away from our flat. Even then I have to stand tall and walk straight as the tears drip down my chin. With every step I take toward the train station, a single thought is berating me. My last words to Henri should have been, "I love you." If I could go back 15 minutes, just 15 minutes, that is what I would tell him before turning away with a flippant farewell and going down the stairs. And Picon, oh God, I can't even think about that terrified howling of his. He knew I was leaving, possibly forever, and he was trying to call me back. The train station is 10 blocks from our flat, and I walk there in a daze. I check the boards and see that the next train for Toulouse doesn't leave for another 30 minutes, so I find a public restroom, lock myself in the stall, and sit on the toilet, blowing my nose and wiping mascara from my cheeks. My breath comes in hard little hiccups that hurt my back. There is a cut on the inside of my lower lip, and I'm stunned to realize it was caused by my own teeth gnawing as I walked. My hands are shaking. My heart is pounding in my chest. I am sweating. It's done. It's over. I've left. And I have to pull myself together, or the last 3 years of my life and all that Henri has sacrificed will be for nothing. I check the contents of my purse and find my wallet, toiletries, brush, makeup, and papers. Henri has sent me away as Madame Fiocca, though not the British subject of the same name, as well as a good amount of money and all my favorite jewelry. I find my engagement ring in an inside pocket and slide it onto my hand. My fingers are slimmer than they were when we married. Everything is slimmer thanks to rationing, and it moves easily over the second knuckle. I spin the ring around on my finger 3 times, reciting his full name, Henri Edmond Fiocca, as I breathe through my nose. The money I separate into 2 different stacks and tuck inside the cuffs of my brassiere, leaving out only enough to buy my ticket and whatever meal they are serving on the train. I am overwhelmed, angry, utterly in love with my husband. I feel everything all at once. But I am no longer crying. Once I am certain I won't scare anyone,
I leave the stall and inspect my reflection in the mirror. I look atrocious. So bad, in fact, that I will draw attention to myself. I brush my hair, apply a fresh coat of lipstick, pinch my cheeks until they are so pink no one will notice my bloodshot eyes, lift my chin. Then I go buy my train ticket. 15 minutes. That's all I have to let O'Leary know what's happened. But the Marseille station does not yet have public telephones. I have to charm my way into the ticket office and convince the station manager to let me use the phone. I need to speak with my husband, I tell him. It's an emergency. He is unconvinced.
What kind of emergency?
Thank goodness for my pinched cheeks. They give the illusion of a blush. I am about to make a 5-hour journey,
as are most of the other people on that platform.
And my monthly cycle has started.
I look at the floor for effect, gnaw the corner of my lip.
But I've forgotten the necessary supplies at home, if you take my meaning.
A glance upward, and then back at the toe of my shoe.
And I am afraid that unless my husband brings them to me, I will, bleed all over the...
Fine, but make it quick,
he interrupts,
unwilling to hear any more about my imaginary affliction. He ushers me into the back room, and I close the door behind him and snort. Men. I have known them to sit and discuss hemorrhoids, ejaculation, diarrhea, vomit, and countless other bodily fluids without so much as a hint of discomfort. But menstruation? Perish the thought. I dial the number for the safe house in Toulouse, hoping to get O'Leary, but there is no answer on the other end. I hang up after 10 rings. Then I try again, letting it ring 15 times, and again 20 this time. Nothing. There is a pounding on the office door, a rumble on the tracks as the train chugs to life. The staticky announcement over the loudspeakers that the train to Toulouse will be departing in 3 minutes. I have counted another 25 rings when someone finally picks up the phone.
Allô?
A woman's voice, breathless, as though she has just run up several flights of stairs.
Damn it.
May I speak with Patrick O'Leary?
No, he is not here.
Is this Françoise? A pause, and then, oui. The train whistle blows loud and clear.
Please tell him that Lucien Carlier called, and that I am sorry to have missed him.
Should he return your call?
No, I won't be here to receive it.
I hang up the phone, throw the door open, speed walk through the ticket office and onto the platform. I step into the train carriage right before the door closes, and I stand there, forehead pressed to the glass, hoping that O'Leary will correctly interpret my message. Toulouse. The weather is atrocious, wet and cold and windy. There is frost forming at the corners of my window, and I think that it is about to start snowing at any moment. The damn Pyrenees. It feels as though the mountain range that forms the border between France and Spain has its own climate, different from either neighbour, and pushes all its cold air down into the surrounding countryside. We are less than a mile from Toulouse when I feel the train begin to slow. Then we are all thrown forward as it stops abruptly on the tracks. I'm not expecting the whistle, and like everyone else in our carriage, I startle at the sound. Then the doors are thrown back, and we are boarded by a dozen armed Vichy police officers. Merde, I hiss under my breath. Even if the window were open, I couldn't make it out in time.
What's going on?
One of the passengers behind me asks. There is a tremor of fear in his voice that makes me wince. Fear is an impossible luxury. Get a hold of yourself, man.
You are all coming with us,
one of them says, and I take him to be in charge because he is wearing a round black helmet. It's shiny, like a beetle, as are the buttons on his coat.
Where?
The man behind me asks, and I want to slap him. The tremor is louder now, and Beetle Cap is looking at him with far too much curiosity.
to the police station.
He waves an arm, and the other officers move forward, guns drawn.
Off the train, now!
I was right. It's snowing. I step off the train into the early evening air to find the first light flakes beginning to fall. One lands on the tip of my nose, and I watch it melt with crossed eyes. Then there is little time for further observations about the weather, because we are all loaded onto a series of waiting trucks and driven to the police station. If O'Leary received my message, he will be waiting for me at the Hotel Paris, which is neither a hotel nor Parisian, but rather the safe house operated by Françoise. It's where we sent Ian Garrow and hundreds of other displaced, abandoned, and persecuted refugees, prisoners, and Jews. If he did not receive my message, he will not be waiting for me at all, and I am on my own. I'd like to kick something, but the only things near enough are the bars of my cell, and that would do no good. The Vichy police put me in 2 hours ago, along with the other women from my carriage, but they have all been released, so it's only me now. I sit and bide my time, because I know what's coming next. As it turns out, I don't have to wait long. My stomach has just announced that dinner is late when one of the younger police officers approaches the cell, unlocks it, and points at me.
"You," he says, "come with me."
I am taken to a small interrogation room down the hall. It is empty except for a scuffed table and two wooden chairs. Beetle Cap is sitting in one, and I am directed to the other.
"Name?"
he asks, and his voice echoes off the bare cinder block walls. I sit, open my purse, remove my papers, and hand them over.
"Madame Fioca?"
"Oui."
"Where were you born?"
"Welling bloody fuckington, New Zealand, you traitorous bag of shit," I think, but do not say, of course. And I am pleased that my voice sounds only tired and not enraged when I answer, "In France."
"Where?"
"Nice."
"So it says here."
"Then why ask?"
"Just being thorough."
He taps my papers against his chin.
"What are you doing in Toulouse?"
"Getting away from my husband for the weekend."
"And why would you want to do that?"
"Because he's being a proper ass at the moment and I wanted a few days to myself."
"Just a few days?"
"Yes."
"Why Toulouse?"
"It was the first train leaving when I reached the station."
"Then where is your suitcase?"
"On the train, with all the others," I lie.
"What color is it?"
"Brown."
He snorts.
"Half the bags in France are brown."
"Then it will probably take you a while to find the right one if you intend to search it."
Beetle Cap shifts in his chair. He studies my papers again, looks at me over the top of them.
"Where are you coming from?"
"Marseille."
"Interesting," he mutters.
Then he stands and moves to the door.
"Wait here. I need to make a phone call."
Not like I have any choice in the matter, since he locks the door behind him. Beetle Cap is back in less than 2 minutes, far too quickly for him to have called anyone. I notice that my papers are now tucked into his shirt pocket, and it is a struggle to keep my hands wrapped around the handles of my purse instead of reaching across the table and yanking them away.
"You are lying,"
he says once he's seated again.
"No.
I called my associates in Marseille. There is no one by the name of Fioca in that city."
"Ah, okay. So this is the game we're playing." I loop my purse over the crook of my arm, get up, walk to the door, then turn to him with the most pompous look of expectation I can muster.
"What are you doing?"
he asks.
"Going back to my cell. You don't believe me, and I have nothing of interest to tell you."
He stands and takes 3 steps toward me.
"You could start with the truth."
"I've told you the truth."
"No. The truth, mademoiselle, is that you match the description of a known prostitute from Lourdes."
His mouth twists into a lascivious grin as he looks at my chest.
Black hair? Blue eyes? Excellent figure.
My eyes are green. It's a common mistake that people make, particularly from a distance, and while it irritates me, it does not offend me. The insinuation that I trade sex for money, however, well, it takes a moment to gather a full head of steam, but my voice is properly outraged when I say, I am no... The slap is so quick that I never see it coming. It knocks me to the side and I stumble into the door. Stars explode across my field of vision and I taste blood in my mouth. The cut from this morning, no doubt. My teeth are throbbing. The skin on my left cheek is on fire. My eyes begin to water. Beetle Cap lifts the whistle from around his neck and blows it hard as though I'm some pickpocket trying to get away. It sounds like hell and damnation inside my already ringing skull. The door is thrown back a moment later, and two officers wearing Vice Squad arm patches step in and grab me. Clearly, they've been waiting outside the door this entire time.
Take her back to her cell, Beetle Cap says.
After 30 minutes of begging, I am finally allowed to use the toilet. And even then, one of the vice officers follows me into the tiny water closet. I am exhausted, I am hungry, and my bladder is so full and heavy one sneeze could leave me drenched. But having an audience is just too much.
Get out! I was told to watch you. Whether you piss or not is none of my concern.
I would very much like a gun right now. I would like to shoot him in the crotch so he has to pee sitting down for the rest of his life.
You could at least turn around.
I could, but I won't.
My only alternative is wetting myself, and since I have no idea how long I'll be here or if I'll ever get a change of clothes, I do the thing that has to be done. A contortionist would be proud of the maneuvers I take to keep myself covered, as much as possible at least. The humiliation of it, however, leaves me red in the face and shaking, and I think that perhaps I've never heard anything so loud as the prolonged trickling that fills the toilet bowl. I am so aware of how vulnerable I am in this moment, how easily I could be overpowered and assaulted, that I swear that I will never be put in this situation again. Not by anyone. Ever. The cleanup required is every bit as demeaning as the act itself, and I make quick use of the toilet paper and drop my skirt, choosing to arrange my undergarments the best I can from the outside, never once breaking eye contact.
Happy? I ask.
He throws open the door.
Wait in the hallway. They want to question you again.
I have done nothing but think of all the things that could go wrong. Hundreds, absolutely hundreds of things could go wrong. No doubt O'Leary would qualify my current predicament as a big Belgian backhander. I have been forced to leave my home, arrested, interrogated, slapped, and subjected to gross voyeurism. But things could be worse. The Gestapo could have me in custody instead of the Vichy police. I lean my head against the wall and turn it to the side so my bruised cheekbone is against the cool plaster. My eyelids weigh 100 pounds and I have to drag them open after a particularly long blink. At first, I think I've imagined him since he's just been running around my thoughts. But no. Patrick O'Leary really is there, and he's standing a few feet away between two Vichy police officers. He says something to one of them, then smiles at me. It's an expression I've never seen on his face before, and it makes a pit open at the bottom of my stomach.
Henri. Henri is surprised at the number of people crowded into Antoine's tonight. He came here to escape the deadening silence in their apartment, only to find the bar filled to capacity. It's the kind of evening Nancy would love. No doubt she would be holding court, regaling this group of strangers with some funny story, and he would be next to her, both marveling and keeping an eye on her admirers. For once, he is not cheered at the thought of his wife. Another? Henri says, raising his glass and motioning to Antoine. The barkeeper limps over to him, bottle of Rémy Martin in hand. He pours two fingers into Henri's glass, but says nothing. Antoine has always had a good sense of when he doesn't want to talk. Henri isn't feeling kindly toward him at the moment anyway. Antoine is the one who got Nancy into this in the first place. Not that it matters much. She would have found her way into resistance work regardless. That's just the kind of woman she is. As promised, Fistol came by the apartment an hour after Nancy left and took her trunk to the train station. If all goes according to plan, it will arrive in Barcelona shortly after she does. "Keep the spare key," Henri told Fistol. "I'll need you to come back a week from today for another trunk, but I won't be here to let you in." There are business affairs he must attend to in Marseille, but Henri plans to wait no longer than necessary before joining his wife in England. Tonight, however, he doesn't have the stomach to be alone. He lifts the glass to his lips and lets the rich, amber liquid slide across his tongue. He could live to be 1,000 years old, and the joy of good brandy would never be lost on him. The bar stool next to Henri has remained empty for much of the night. He clearly doesn't look like pleasant company, but someone slides onto it now. He turns his head to the right. The face before him is familiar, but he struggles to place it.
"Bonjour, Henri," she says.
The voice brings everything together. He did not recognize her because her head has been shaved, and without her long blonde hair, each of her features looks strange and out of place. "Marceline." She leans in for la bise, the customary double kiss favored by his countrymen, but he turns his face away. Marceline pouts.
"What's wrong? Don't you like me anymore, Henri?"
"I never liked you."
"You liked me just fine, from what I remember. No need to lie. It isn't very nice."
"Neither are you." He watches as she sets a self-conscious hand against her head, fingering the uneven locks. "You are working with the Germans?"
"No. I am loyal to Vichy. It's not the same thing."
"You're right. It's worse."
"That wife of yours has infected you with stupid ideas. France belongs to the French. I couldn't care less if the Germans purge the foreigners."
"By which you mean Jews?" The corner of her mouth curls upward. Most men would be enchanted by Marceline's smile, her bright teeth and the sharp point of her Cupid's bow. But he has always found it threatening and calculated, as though she wants to bite him.
"And Australians?"
Henri is rarely unkind to women, but he doesn't have the patience for Marceline tonight. As usual, she is wearing far less than the weather requires. He recognizes the brown satin blouse as the same one she wore to dinner several years back with Nancy and his father. But, like everyone in Marseille, she has lost weight, and it hangs looser on her now.
"I know your wife is away, and she won't know we've spent the evening together unless you tell her."
"We are not spending the evening together."
"Why shouldn't we? We're both adults. The night is young."
"Good night."
Henri sets his glass down and leans away from her. He no longer wants his brandy. He no longer wants to be here at all.
"Wait."
Marceline sets her hand on his knee and runs it up his thigh.
"You have needs. I can meet them."
He knocks her hand away and stands up.
"Leave me alone."
Henri digs through his wallet and pulls out enough to cover his tab and tip Antoine as well.
"Walking away from me would be a mistake, Henri."
He shakes his head in disgust and leaves the bar, cursing quietly as Marceline follows him. But he stops at the door, inches before colliding with Police Commissioner Paquet.
"This would have been so much easier if you'd just taken me home. I did give you the chance," Marceline says. "Now, It would be best if you didn't make a scene.
Best for who?
He turns, slowly, to look her in the eye, because something has just occurred to him. He takes one menacing step toward her.
How did you know my wife is away?
She closes the gap between them and sets one palm against his cheek. He tries to shake it off, but she returns that hand to his skin with a sharp little slap. Once again, her voice is so low that only he can hear it.
Who do you think has been following her all these weeks? Your wife bought a ticket to Toulouse this afternoon and took nothing but her purse. This trip is quite different than the others, I think. As a matter of fact, I doubt she'll be coming back at all. I've already phoned the Vichy police to let them know which carriage she's riding in.
Enough. He turns from Marceline and moves toward the door again, but Paquet steps forward.
What are you doing here? Henri asks. You can come with us willingly, Paquet says, or I can arrest you in front of everyone.
On what charge?
I don't need one. Vichy has given me the authority to perform preventative arrests any time I see fit. I can imprison you on the mere suspicion of being an enemy of the state.
Henri has just enough time to glance at Antoine before getting shoved into the lobby. The barkeeper, helpless to do anything else, nods once in acknowledgement. As usual, the lobby is filled with brown shirts, and each of them watches, curious, as Henri, Marceline, and Paquet pass through. Once outside the hotel and down the broad steps, Paquet leads him toward a black vehicle flanked by two more Vichy police officers with pistols in their hands. The back door is open, and Marceline saunters past him and climbs inside. She pats the seat beside her.
Do get in, she says. I didn't like it the last time you sent me off alone.
Toulouse. My thoughts collide like marbles being shaken around in a bucket. I left that message for O'Leary. My train was boarded outside Toulouse. I was arrested, interrogated, knocked around. And now O'Leary is here, standing between Beetlecap and one of the vice officers, looking for all the world like the cat that ate the canary. Those marbles start shattering now, sharp little splinters spinning off inside my mind, vicious in their destructive possibilities. I trusted O'Leary. He knows everything about our resistance operation. He knows everything about my husband. Has he betrayed me? Am I capable of killing a man with my bare hands? Because that's what I'd like to do right now as I look at him. O'Leary whispers something else to Beetlecap and begins to walk toward me. I curl my fists and open my mouth to hurl the best insults I know. Before I can speak, however, he hisses, "Smile, you fool. You're supposed to be my mistress." And then he gives me the most aggressive, ridiculous kiss right in the middle of the hallway. It's like something from a silent movie, exaggerated, pantomimed. What the ever-loving hell? "Come on, then," he says, loud enough for everyone to hear as he smacks my rear end. "Let's get you out of here, darling." I am not the sort of woman who is often rendered speechless, but I stare at him, pop-eyed. "I have a few questions first, if you don't mind. In my office," Beetlecap says. By this point, O'Leary has grabbed my hand and is squeezing so hard I'm certain he's cut off my blood supply. But I get the message. "Don't say a word, Nance. Let me do the talking." "Why did you lie to me?" Beetlecap demands once we're standing before his desk. He looks at me as though I've murdered a puppy. O'Leary clears his throat. "As you can imagine, my friend here has a very, jealous husband. He's an important man. Wealthy. Likes maintaining control of his own property, if you know what I mean. So we prefer to keep our rendezvous a secret." That's all she had to say. "It was none of your—" O'Leary squeezes my hand again, so I snap my mouth closed.
Get out, he says, disgusted. Both of you.
O'Leary wastes no time thanking Beetlecap and steering me into the hallway.
Is that it? I whisper.
You want more? Because I don't. Let's get out of here while we can.
O'Leary has one hand and my purse dangles from the other.
But he still has my papers.
Your pick, Nance. Your life or your papers?
Fair enough. Once we're outside on the street and have walked several blocks, I laugh and throw my arms around O'Leary. Thank you, I say. But if you ever put your dirty Belgian tongue in my mouth again, I will strangle you with it.
How on earth did you find me? I ask O'Leary.
We have been walking through the streets of Toulouse for an hour. Our safe house is less than a mile away, but he wants to make sure we're not being followed. So we take a winding route through several wealthy neighborhoods, and I lean against him, freezing.
I got your message, he says. So I guessed you left Marseille and would be coming to Toulouse. And when you never showed up at the safe house, I knew that something had happened during the trip. I was just relieved to hear from our whisper network that the arrest had happened here instead of somewhere else along the tracks. I might have never found you had that been the case.
But you walked right into Vichy headquarters. Do you even understand how risky that was?
Patrick O'Leary stops then, right in the middle of the street. He sticks a finger in my face and shakes it.
And you walked right into Mozak to free Ian Garrow. Did you think I would do any less for you?
My face burns bright, and I hope he interprets it as gratitude and not the shame I feel for believing that he had betrayed me.
But how? I ask. How on earth did you ever convince them to let me go?
He shrugs.
You aren't the only one with fake names and documents. I keep a set stating I'm a member of the milice.
I raise one eyebrow. He laughs.
I may have also insinuated that I am a close associate of Pierre Laval.
The Vichy vice president?
I would have gone for Marshal Pétain himself, but claiming to be friends with the president seemed a bit like overkill. Besides, I happen to know that Laval is in Berlin right now, so they had to take my word for it. And rejecting me was the greater risk since they had nothing on you.
I shake my head. There are a few street lamps in this part of town, and the shadows stretch long between the buildings. The snow has stopped, but there is a fine dusting of powder still on the ground, and the stars have been swallowed by low-hanging clouds. I shiver, and then I am overcome with the urge to cry. I shove the heels of my hands into my eyes to stem the flow.
What's wrong?
I'm just glad it worked, I say.
Well, you're not in the clear yet, Nance. There's still a mountain between you and freedom.
Patrick O'Leary delivers me into the capable arms of Françoise 30 minutes later. She is the ugliest woman I have ever met. Her face is a perfect square, and she has the strangest owl eyes, enormous, unblinking, and so light brown they are almost yellow. But there doesn't seem to be a single eyelash on either top or bottom lids. Her brown hair is parted down the middle and pulled into two tight plaits that fall to her waist. It is impossible to tell her age because she doesn't do a single thing to improve her looks. And then, of course, there's the fact that she is an incurable chain smoker. Inside, outside, it doesn't matter. She is never without a cigarette holder in one hand and a drink in the other. Françoise has never volunteered her last name, and as far as I know, no one in the resistance network has ever asked. The less we know, the better. She cuts an intimidating figure, and I doubt the information could be wrestled out of her regardless. Much like Marseille, Toulouse is an old city constructed around the whims of long-gone farmers and merchants. But without the seaport, it has less charm and feels claustrophobic to me. Once we are situated in her flat, Françoise is quick to tell me that she owns and operates the bakery three floors below us. The floors between are her personal residence. The attic, where I now find myself, is where she hides and feeds the refugees whom we send to her. It feels strange to be in need of her services myself. Once we are alone, she turns to me, cheeks pink, and asks, "How is Antoine?" I haven't seen him in a few days, but I believe he's well. She sighs, wistful.
"Handsomest man I've ever met. I've fancied him for years, even though my mother once made me promise I'd never bear the Corsican. Said they're all devils."
My mouth falls open. I snap it shut. I cannot imagine Françoise and Antoine in the same room together, much less the same bed. So I nod and say, "He's a good man."
"Pity about that wife of his."
"He's married?" I gasp.
"She won't leave Corsica, and he won't leave her."
"I've known the man for 7 years, and he's never mentioned a wife."
"Love is strange," she tells me, and then, "Sleep. We have much to arrange tomorrow."
I wake to sunlight and a gentle shake from Patrick O'Leary. "Get up," he says. "I'd rather not if it's all the same to you. Listen, I'm heading out and I need to give you instructions. I can't do that while you're drooling on the furniture."
"I do not drool,"
I argue, wiping my chin even as I glare at O'Leary. "I am a deep sleeper, that's all."
"Well, all that sleep of yours is messing up the throw pillows."
I hurl one of said pillows at his head and he ducks just in time.
"I'm off to meet with a new volunteer. He was brought on by a colleague in Paris and has made his way south to help move people through the escape route."
I sit up, stretch, yawn.
"If you give me a few minutes to clean up, I can come with you."
"No, I can't take you along."
"Why?"
"Because something seems off about him.
When we made contact a few days ago by phone, he asked if I would bring along that amusing girl from Marseille that he's heard so much about in Paris."
"How has he heard about me?"
"That is the very thing I aim to discover."
"Then why the hell are you going? This could be a trap."
"Yes, it could be. And I'll find out soon enough since I told him that I would bring you along."
"Have you lost your damn mind?" I ask. "What the hell do you plan to do if he corners you?"
He smiles then. "I mean to kill him. Because if he is who I suspect him to be, then it means we have a traitor in our organization. If I am not back by noon, you are to leave here immediately and head for the Pyrenees. Do you understand?"
"Yes, but there are no buts, Nance." He taps my forehead with his finger, hard, 3 times.
"They had you at the train station, and I won't let that happen again. You know too much. You are too important to this organization. I cannot let you be captured."
"So you're going to throw yourself into a trap?"
"No. I'm going to figure out who betrayed Garrow and who got you arrested."
O'Leary steps back and walks toward the door.
"Remember, if I'm not back by noon, you run. Promise?"
Everything about this feels wrong to me.
"O'Leary, who is this man you're meeting?"
His jaw is clenched so hard his teeth are grinding together.
"Say it."
"I promise, okay? I swear. But who is this man?"
"They call him the Legionnaire, but his name is Roger Le Neveu."
I don't wait until noon, because Françoise delivers the news with my breakfast. She bustles into the attic carrying a tray laden with freshly baked bread, soft butter, and cold milk.
"I will never be able to eat all this. You've brought too much," I tell her.
"I know," she says. "Some is for breakfast. The rest is for your journey."
Just like that, I am no longer hungry.
"What happened to him?"
"The daughter of a friend works at the bistro where O'Leary met this man Roger. She's a mousy little thing, quite unattractive if I'm being honest. It's her greatest gift. No one pays her any mind. She snuck away and came straight to me."
"And what did she tell you?"
Françoise looks at me with her curious owl eyes, and they are filled with genuine grief.
That the moment O'Leary sat down at the table, he was surrounded by Gestapo agents. They arrested him on the spot. As they dragged him through the door, she heard Roger giving instructions that he was to be taken directly to the train station.
We have to help him.
No, you promised him, remember?
Her words sting like lemon juice in a cut. I knew I shouldn't have let him force me into that promise. But I nod, because Françoise strikes me as the sort of woman who does not tolerate broken promises.
Besides, she says, my little friend says his train has already departed. He is to be interrogated en route.
They are sending him to Dachau.